This land was made for you and me.
Hello, everybody. Good evening. This is Beth, our head of the People Speak radio show, and welcome to our show tonight. Here at People Speak, we believe when we speak, we can make a difference. Tonight, we're speaking with Elizabeth Riviera Goldstein of TeenPeace.org. Elizabeth is a resident of the state of Washington and a mother of two teens and an activist. It was the concern over her children and other children that propelled Liz into activism. Concern over the possibility of a draft and military recruiters on campus talking students into joining the military. Well, that was the reason Liz founded TeenPeace.org. Hi, Liz. How are you?
Hi, I'm just fine. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, it's our honor and a pleasure. I'm a peace activist of the old world myself, and I'm just thrilled to have you here. What is Teen Peace, Elizabeth?
Teen Peace started as a homeschooling project for my children about 5 years ago. They're actually no longer teens. They're both young adults and off at college. And at the time when there was the lead-up to the Iraq War, I began to get worried that we would be in for a long slog in Iraq, and I talked to my husband about becoming a conscientious objector because he had been a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War. And so, in typical homeschool mother fashion, I looked for information to share with my children to help them consider for themselves if they felt they were conscientious objectors. And I told some other friends that I was doing that, and they looked at each other and thought, gee, we should be doing that for our kids, too. And the next thing I knew, I had seven teenagers in my living room discussing war and peace and nonviolence and Gandhi and Martin Luther King. And it just snowballed. It's been amazing how far this work has taken me from this little rural town in Port Townsend to traveling around the country, helping to organize some national counter-recruiting conferences, bringing together activists from across the world. I was elected to the National Steering Committee for United for Peace and Justice, and for the last 2.5 years, I've flown to New York every 3 months and met with other activists to help work on a national scale. And then in 2005, I was chosen as a Donna di Pace, or Woman of Peace. An Italian organization had found my website, and they invited me to go to Italy with other women peace activists from around the world to talk about our work and to travel across Italy and lecture and for us to get to know each other, and we're hoping to do future work together.
Sounds like an amazing project, and you're right, it has grown phenomenally. You and others help encourage teens to become conscientious objectors. It's not necessarily a popular thing, or is it, today?
I've really seen a change since 2002. When I first used to talk to kids about, do you know what a conscientious objector is, they had no idea. I'd get blank looks. And over the last 5 years, people have come to understand it more as more soldiers have refused to serve, or you hear stories about the small numbers of soldiers who are being allowed to get a discharge as a conscientious objector. More and more people are aware of what that is and what that stand means.
Liz, it's not really easy being a conscientious objector as far as the legalities behind it, is it? I mean, it's actually quite involved to be designated conscientious objector.
There is a very long soul-searching process that one goes through. There's paperwork that the government gives. You can only really be designated as a conscientious objector if you are in the military. Excuse me. And so about half of the people who apply for conscientious objection status are refused, even if it looks like they have made a good case. And the process can take up to 2 years to get a determination. And in the meantime, once a person has announced that they are a conscientious objector, for some service people, it's all right. Their rest of their unit sees that they are a real sincere person and they mean what they say. Other people, it can be a very difficult, sometimes dangerous position to take.
Let me ask you, why are there conscientious observers in the military? Why are they even in the military? That's an unusual dynamic about this.
You know, war changes people, and our whole society glorifies serving in the military, glorifies going to war. There were a lot of lies that were told to this country to encourage people to enlist and to go and serve in Iraq. And as the years are dragging on, people begin to see the realities of being in war, see the realities of being in combat, what it means to kill another person, begin to question, why are we really there? What are we really doing in Iraq? Then the questions come up, and so those experiences can cause a person who may have been very gung-ho to enlist to begin to really question what they're doing, what they're participating in.
People like Aaron Wakata, Lieutenant Aaron Wakata, who you had, I believe, the privilege of helping to coordinate some of the programs surrounded with his, were you not?
I was his mobilization coordinator. I wrote the articles that were on his website, consulted with him, went to his court-martial, organized people to come from all over the country. Some people came from other countries. We held rallies in support and events, educational events in the months leading up to the court-martial so that people would understand his position so that they, that encouraged them to come out. When I was first hired by Lieutenant Wakata, we were expecting that on the first day of his court-martial, maybe 200 or 300 people would come out in support for him. And in the weeks right before the court-martial began last February, we began to realize that it was going to be much bigger than we thought. And there were between 1,500 to 2,000 people who came out for the 3 days of his court-martial.
We had the privilege of having Aaron on the show. He's quite an articulate and wonderful young man, and he's proved positive that a lot of people consider that conscientious observers are cowards. In fact, Aaron knew that we were going to war, and he joined the military knowing that he was going to be required to fight for his country. So this really had nothing to do with his being cowardly or cowardice in any manner. But when he saw what he saw, when he found out the truth of what was happening in Iraq, he decided that this was not a legal war, that this was not a war of democracy or honor, that it was not a war, but rather a war of privilege and the privileges that we took in attacking a nation. How do you feel about what's going on? And let me ask you something, Liz. You're saying that it takes up to 2 years for conscientious observers, in some cases, to become designated that. When you say it happens during that 2 years, are they still obligated to do whatever it is? I mean, let's say that they were to be deployed during that period of time. Are they required to go, or do they have special compensation for them in the military?
They're not supposed to be... It's my understanding that they're not supposed to be shipped out if they start the conscientious objector status before they've been deployed. They're not supposed to be moved. If they file for conscientious objector while they're in Iraq, they're supposed to be reassigned to a different kind of position so that they aren't in a combat position. The thing is, I've heard from Augustine Aguayo, who was a soldier who was imprisoned in Germany. He had gone to Iraq as a medic. As a medic, he expected that he would be giving medical care, not, being told to perform the duties one usually thinks of when you think of being a soldier. And he carried a gun and was ordered to do patrols and to stand guard and to do a lot of things that he had not expected would be his duty. And he knew he would get in a lot of trouble if he refused to carry a gun. So what he did was he went through Baghdad for a year with an unloaded gun. And the rest of his unit respected him. First, I think they thought he was nuts, but they came to respect him and realize he was sincere and that he could not harm another person. And his unit, his superiors, the people who first examined him, all approved his file, his conscientious objector paperwork. But when it got to a desk in the Pentagon, he was denied. And so someone who had never met him or talked to him said, no, we don't believe you. And this led to a series of events where he wound up going to jail for 7 months. And Augustine was facing 7 years in prison. And they gave him credit for time served, and he is now back in the United States and touring the country and talking to people, educating them about what it means to be a conscientious objector and what serving in the military is really like.
Well, that's a very brave man, in my opinion. You know, I'd like to get back to this Teen Peace Project in Port Townsend High School. You had written that as many as 3 times a week during the school year, recruiters from all branches of the military were, like, hanging out at lunchtime. How is that? I mean, if I'm not mistaken, I mean, there are rules that do not allow people to just hang out in school programs. Is this form of indoctrination common, and is it legal?
Unfortunately, it's legal, and it's actually mandated across the country. The No Child Left Behind Act had about 4 paragraphs inserted into it that requires that all schools who receive federal money must allow military recruiters on campuses, in high schools and colleges, and they also have, the schools must provide the military recruiters with the name, address, and phone number of all the students. And the students and their parents are supposed to be informed that this is going on. They have the right to not be on those lists that are supplied to recruiters. But unfortunately, this is followed very unevenly across the country. And there's a lot of people who feel that this is really an invasion of privacy for students. And it's definitely, I feel, giving a message to students that it's absolutely fine and great to join the military, and they aren't given enough of a different viewpoint to help them make an informed decision.
And children at that age, certainly I don't think, have the information or the constitution to develop that kind of a judgment, but it's very lucrative to become to be recruited. They're offering monetary incentives and other things to children. What are some of the things that they're offering children today?
Well, one of the things that's been interesting to me as I've traveled around the country is I live in a small rural town that's predominantly got white people here. And yet the kids that I am working with face the same promises and challenges as inner-city students of color anywhere in the country. And that's because there isn't work here. Farming is dying out. Salmon has been overfished. The fishing industry is gone. Logging's been overdone. The logging industry is gone. And so we have a lot of kids who don't feel that they have a lot of options, that want to see the world. The recruiters promise them that they'll get to travel. They tell them they're going to give them a lot of money for college, or they're going to give them money that they can use as a down payment for a home. They tell them, and I'm amazed how often I still hear this, that they will not have to serve in Iraq. My nephew was recruited in California, and his recruiters swore up and down that he would be such good military material, that they would invest so much money and time into training him to be a good soldier, that they wouldn't waste their investment on blowing him up in Iraq. And he's been in Ramadi for the last year and a half.
Wow, that is amazing.
He's been in Ramadi.
That's an amazing comment.
Yeah, and I've heard that over and over again.
Oh, my God. And let me ask you a question about the recruiters themselves. Do you find any unethical practices that are rampant? From my understanding and some of the study and research that we've done, as a matter of fact, there was an article that had spoken about the actual sexual abuse of young women at the hands of recruiters. that they were truly being unethical in their in the methodologies that they're using to recruit these students.
It was so bad that 2 years ago there was a national stand-down day that the military called to go over ethics with their recruiters. And it's just appalling how there's been case after case. There were kids that were given hidden microphones when they went in to talk to the recruiters to hear all kinds of nonsense. Like, you have a bigger chance of getting shot in the streets of Chicago than you do of being killed in New York. Or you have a greater chance of being killed in a car accident down in Arizona than you do of being killed in Baghdad.
Wow.
And it's just nonsense. But the kids don't know that. The guys throw out numbers and play with figures when you're not looking at the whole population and how many people as a whole are out there as opposed to how few soldiers are there in Iraq and how many are killed and how many are injured. And they're supposed to tell potential recruits what the dangers are that they might face or be exposed to, and yet I have never met anyone who said that their recruiter warned them about being exposed to depleted uranium, about not going near a tank that they just fired. The weapons that our soldiers use carry a radioactive material that, when it is exploded, is extremely dangerous. And yet they're not warned to stay away from that. And when I asked a recruiter if he did that, if he warned them about this potential harm, he just looked at me and said, "That's your job, isn't it?"
Well, in other words, the shifting of responsibility goes on and on. Where are the parents in all of this, and how do the parents feel about the practices of the recruiters in the school system? I'm sure you've talked to a lot of them.
One of the things that I've done is I've organized conferences and traveled around the country speaking to different groups to help parents work with their school boards to protect student privacy, to make sure that they understand what the law is and what their protections are regarding recruiters and contact with students. Down in Seattle, there's been an amazing work done by a group called Youth Against War and Racism, and they recently got the Seattle School Board to limit recruiters to only having contact with the schools twice a year during job fairs. That's one of the things that's interesting about the No Child Left Behind Act, is it says that you have to treat recruiters the same as other recruiters. But you don't have recruiters from Microsoft coming in three times a week. You don't have recruiters from colleges coming in constantly to recruit the kids. The military is the only entity that does that.
Yeah, how much funding is actually, I wonder how much funding is actually involved in the recruitment process. And from my understanding, they're giving like grand totals, like $30,000 to $80,000 in order to be recruited into the military these days.
Well, it costs about $15,000 for each person who is recruited from the time they are contacted till the time they, I believe, they finish boot camp, till the time they're processed through, which is enough. In New York, it's more than enough, or in L.A., it's more than enough to fund an entire year of education for someone. The recruiters are given a bonus for each person that they recruit, and they promise, you know, they have these ads, and you have to be careful how you look, that they say up to a certain amount of money, up to $40,000, up to $80,000. But only 35% of the people who enlist ever get the money, because there are several hoops you have to jump through. You have to make sure that you get a good discharge. If you get in trouble and you get kicked out, you can't do it. You have to pay into the system in order to get money out. And if you miss a payment or you stop paying, you will never get back the money that you paid in to get any funding for college. And the highest amounts of money that are trumpeted are only reserved for about 3% of the positions in the military. They're the ones that are really high risk or extremely technical that very few people could qualify for or would want to take.
Liz, What do the recruiters get out of this? Is there some kind of an incentive that they have? Is this some kind of a commission, like if you recruit so many students or so many people into the military, there is a monetary incentive to them on some level?
Well, they are well paid, and I'm not exactly sure what that is, but I know that, they make a pretty good income. They are under pressure to produce. They have a quota that they have to fulfill, and if they don't meet it, they can have their pay cut. They can be kicked out of a cushy recruiting job where you get to dress up really nice, drive around in your fancy car, and hang out with young people and pretend like you're their buddy, to having to go and serve somewhere else, like maybe in Iraq. It's a, you know, I do have some compassion for recruiters because they are under incredible pressure to recruit people. And, you know, their families depend on them, and they get used to a certain lifestyle, and they may go ahead and buy themselves a home and get themselves committed into a mortgage and a car payment. And then if they're not doing good, then they're in big trouble. They can get busted down. They can lose their own benefits and their own careers. The thing is, you know, somebody ought to think before they step into that. And I've been told that, you know, not everybody chooses to be a recruiter. Sometimes you're ordered to be a recruiter. And so I understand that. And yet I really don't know how they sleep at night.
Well, it seems that the way it works is that the incentive is to continue working for the incentive. It's almost a cyclical battle, uphill battle. You, the children and the kids and teens that come out of these programs, this training program that you have, they in turn go out and promote teen peace and conscientious objector status to other people in other schools. How do you train them?
Well, when we first began, it was a lot of me talking, and I didn't really want to do that because I've told the kids over and over that what I think doesn't matter. If there ever is a draft again, they're the ones who are going to have to make their case to a draft board and to fill out the paperwork to become a conscientious objector. And it's not going to do them any good if they are all parroting what I think. And so I frustrate the kids sometimes because when we have discussions, I ask them a lot of questions, but they ask me what I think, and I just tell them over and over again, doesn't matter what I think, it matters what you think. And I think that actually if it's known that they were coming through the Teen Peace Project, their case might be more suspect. And so I really try and get the kids to understand these issues. I ask different ones to read different bits of, you know, what's required to become a conscientious objector. We use a text. It's not a textbook, it's a handbook called Choosing Peace, which is put out by the Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors. And that book was written for an individual to sit and read and ask themselves questions about war and violence and force and what's a just war and things like that. And we use it as a discussion guide. And there are questions in the book that are meant for an individual to sit and journal for themselves what their thoughts are. And we have discussions together, and we go and hear other speakers, and I bring vets in to have dinner with the kids so that they can talk to them about what their time was like in the military. And once the students that I'm working with feel pretty comfortable, it was interesting to me. I had actually intended that they would only work with me for 6 to 8 weeks, and we'd talk about this stuff, and then they'd go on their way. And instead, the kids told me that it was really interesting, and they wanted more. And so the whole program developed with guidance, really, from the students that were in the program to have them lead the next group of kids that came in. They started telling their friends what they were doing, and their friends wanted to come. And so I basically just sat back and let the kids talk to their friends, and when they felt comfortable, instead of me going around the state and lecturing, I would introduce the kids and let them take the floor. And I have found that it's so much more powerful. I just turned 50 last week. I look like an overprotective mom.
When
the kids speak, their peers come. More students will come when they know that it's students who are going to talk with them. and they listen. And one of the things that I noticed was in the first year and a half, I was doing the presentations by myself. And I would meet different people, and there would be some students who would come, and I'd check back with the communities, and not too much was happening. But after the kids started doing the presentations, I would hear back that students in cities all around Washington State had then started their own discussion groups. And that's why if you go to the teenpeace.org website, there's a lot of information for anyone anywhere. A student can do it on their own if there's another parent or a teacher. I've had letters from teachers across the country who use some of the information on my website as discussion and essay topics for the kids in their classrooms. And I really tried to set this up so that anyone could do this. And the only thing that I really ask people to try and do, and it's tough, I find I struggle with it myself, is let the kids find their own thoughts. And I think that's why Teen Peace has worked so well.
Well, I think that's an excellent attitude. As a matter of fact, that was the very type of attitude that we had when we started the People Speak Radio, was that we indeed wanted the people to speak. We wanted them to engage in the process. We have a caller on line 3 right now, Mike from California. Mike has a question for you, Liz.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, Liz. Thanks for coming on the show. I was wondering, you know, there's some notably famous Vietnam vets. Perhaps one of the most famous is Ron Kovic, whose life story was portrayed in Born on the 4th of July by Tom Cruise. And I was wondering if you're working with any of these vets, like the Vets for Peace or the Iraq Veterans Against the War, and take them to the high schools and combine efforts in reaching out to the kids and telling them, hey, this guy went there. He'll tell you what it's like.
The relationship that we've had with the vets has been the most powerful. I began years ago by joining the Vets for Peace chapter that was near where I lived, so that I could meet vets and understand what veterans' issues are. And then I started setting up pizza dinners where we would invite 3 vets to come meet with the kids and have dinner together. And the first time that we did that, the veterans decided on their own to bring their high school yearbook picture, so that instead of looking at these Vietnam vets who have gray-haired and long ponytails, they were looking at pictures of young men, some with shoulder-length hair, some with not-so-long hair, who were the same age as the kids were that were in the program. And then they would talk about who they were when they were in high school and why they enlisted or what happened when they were drafted. And it helped the kids to really see these men as having something in common with them, and the conversations just took off from there. I have brought Michael Hoffman from Iraq Vets Against the War. Michael Kuzort came out. I take the kids whenever there's vets who speak. We all pile in cars. If we have to drive for 2 hours to get down to Seattle, we go and hear them speak. If somebody's on television, I'll record the program and bring it into the group to watch and discuss. And it's been the most important thing. Again, you know, I'm just a mom. I don't have the experience that the men and women in Iraq Vets Against the War and Vets for Peace have. And I have so much admiration for these people who walked in places that I will probably never walk. And they have a wisdom and an understanding and a pain that not everyone shares. And I think that it's just as good for the vets to talk with the kids as it is for the kids to talk to the vets.
Well, our next guest on the phone is Steve from Santa Fe. Do you have a question for Liz?
Yes, Basma, thank you for taking my question. And Liz, if I may, I am a Veterans for Peace. I work here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And just real quick, leave my child alone, .org.
We'll
keep these piranhas, for lack of a better word. from attacking our children. I do have a question to Liz. First, I'd like to thank you for your service and for your care and your all the time you're putting in. You know, current events today are showing us that people that use free speech in protest, I'm talking about the Code Pink arrest in Washington, D.C. for reading the Constitution, that they're coming down hard on people like us. Do you think that's going to help or hurt the movement? It's your mic, sir.
I can only hope that it's going to help the movement. I've been arrested 3 times at protests in the last year, and the first 2 times the charges were dropped with prejudice. That means you're not supposed to be recharged or charged with some other offense for the same incident. And last week my attorney informed me that I have been recharged again. And we seem to be losing basic tenets of law and basic protections of our Constitution. I mean, that's one of the questions with Lieutenant Watata's court-martial. It's not supposed to happen until an appellate court decides if this is a case of double jeopardy or not. And yet they're going to move forward. They're saying that the court-martial begins next week. I've just been told that I have to go back and face a trial again for charges that were dropped and should not have been recharged. So I'm hoping that the people who are stepping up and speaking out, putting their bodies on the line, will encourage more people to really see what's happening to our country and move to do what they can to get our country back.
Liz, what were the charges against you?
Two of the charges were a misdemeanor. They were for blocking the road to a Navy base near where I live. And one of the arrests was down at the Port of Tacoma. In March, the port military resistance had 2 weeks of protests when the military was shipping equipment to Iraq to support the surge, and material was going out of Fort Lewis.
That was the Indian Island Navy.
Indian Island, yeah, is where I blocked the road to the base. And then when I went down with, there was a lot of students and a lot of community members from the Olympia and Tacoma area and around the state of Washington to protest using a city port to ship military equipment. I was actually arrested for having a backpack. Now, as far as I know, it's not against the law to have a backpack on a public street. But the police said that if I crossed the street wearing my backpack, they would arrest me. And so I looked him in the eye and said, I don't believe you have the authority to do that, and I will challenge it in court. And when we had 8 days of being stuck in court all day while the attorneys and the judge argued, it was determined that there was no law against carrying a backpack and that the charges were dropped. And as I said, we've suddenly been told that we're being charged again. I don't even know what I'm being charged with this time.
Well, I find it fascinating that our activists and our protesters are being targeted in such a way. Excuse me, I have a terrible cold. But let me, you know, let's get back to something that you had said, that in the No Child Left Behind Act, there are provisions that were put into that, conditions, and one of them was that we allow these recruiters in. And do you believe that as our rights are being chipped away in free speech and protest, also that these laws are being slipped through without a notice on purpose?
I think it is. There's so much maneuvering that's going on. There's so much that is inserted into a law. I mean, who would imagine that a military recruitment mandate would be in an educational bill? And yet there is so much that's in there that besides the requiring recruiters to be in the school, it's encouraging people in armed services to volunteer in their schools in uniform. There's even a provision that would allow someone who'd been in the military to take just a few weeks of certification and bump a tenured teacher out of a teaching position.
You're kidding.
No. And those are things that most people don't know. I mean, I downloaded the PDF file on my computer. I came up with something like 687 pages. And, you know, thank goodness for computers and searches for words that I knew it was Section 9528 of the No Child Left Behind Act that really deals with military recruiters. But there's a lot of stuff in there that is pretty surprising.
Kind of like the Patriots Act for children in elementary school.
Well, they go in and they talk to kids. They bring soldiers in to talk to young ones. There was a huge protest, I believe, down in Los Angeles a couple years back because they had a general come in and talk to fifth graders. Recently near my house, they parked a tank in the parking lot of a Target and then encouraged little kids to climb up on it and have their parents take pictures. And we're talking about preschoolers.
You know, it is an amazing process that seems to be taking over our schools. There is a trainer by the name of David Grossman. He's also a writer, and he works with a process called killology. And killology is how they indoctrinate, for all intents and purposes, just normal kids and children and teens into becoming killing machines for the military. He certainly isn't doing that anymore, and I think that his concern is that we have raised a very violent society. Do you, in these areas, address that kind of indoctrination into the acts of violence that we are perpetrating in other countries?
Absolutely. There's one of the reasons that my work went from the local level to the national level was because we became aware through a newspaper article that military recruiters were renting video arcade halls and then holding tournaments using the America's Army game. And they were inviting kids as young as 13 to be in these tournaments. And while the kids were in playing this violent video game that, you know, you get to pretend that you're a soldier, the recruiters were giving recruiting spiels to kids. And I read this to the students that I worked with, and I was furious. I was so upset, I didn't even know what to do. And I read it to the kids, and I said, do you think this is good? What do you think we should do? And the kids came up with an idea about having a national program, which we proposed to United for Peace and Justice, and they've asked us to work on it and come back. But what we would do is we would have some kids that felt comfortable actually go in to these events and then question the recruiters. Don't allow their statements to go unquestioned. Meanwhile, kids that didn't feel comfortable with being a part of the video game would be outside passing out counter-recruiting leaflets. We called this the War is Not a Game campaign. And I'm hoping that we'll get to do that in the future. One of the things that happened was we tried to go to an event here and they wouldn't let us in.
Really?
Yeah.
And what was the name of the event?
You know, they don't put it... If you go to the Army's website, they used to have these tournaments right on the front page. It was really easy to find them. And after we proposed this at the national level, it became very, very hard to find the events. And it's amazing.
Probably hard for adults, but I don't think it was too hard for children, too.
Yeah, well, you know, they'll set up at a gun show. And the military will be there with video games at a gun and rifle show.
Really? Wow. Just unbelievable the lengths that they're going to. You can call toll-free for those of you that would like to ask Elizabeth Rivera.
Liz Rivera-Goldstein. Yeah, it's a long name.
toll-free in the U.S. is 877-270-8714. And for our Canadian listeners, 888-228-4494. Please call in if you have any questions for Liz. Into fasting. We do have a caller. Sue, one of our star supporters of our show from Massachusetts. Sue, you have a question?
Yes, I do, Liz. You were talking that you started locally and went on a nationwide campaign to, you know, to stop recruiters and, you know, Teens for Peace and so on and so forth. I'm curious, Liz, do you have chapters throughout the United States where someone who is a concerned citizen could actually join your organization? Would that be on your website?
There's information on my website.
You know, a written type of thing? I'm just curious because this is very interesting to me. Go ahead, please, Liz. Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, there is information on the website, and I'm happy to correspond or talk with anybody that wants to do that. I'm actually about to go back to college so that I can learn more. I want to go to the Center for Social Change at Antioch College so that I can learn how to do a better job of growing teen peace. Another thing that has happened is when I was on the tour in Italy with the other women peace activists from around the world, one of the mothers from Chechnya, she and I realized that we both had the same idea that we would like to see a program where parents pledge from birth or from very young to raise their children to be conscientious objectors, to make a conscious effort to confront the militarism that's in our society and to help teach our kids to think about other ways of resolving conflict. And so someday I'm going to get back to Russia and meet with the women that I met from there, and we're going to work on putting that program together.
Well, I think that's a wonderful idea. And then one of the things that we have to realize from everything that we have been witnessing in the world and the way our these multi-wars that are suddenly presenting themselves, they're not presenting themselves, we're starting wars from all over the world. And this... ...50 years. So I think we have to... I guess I'm having some problems here. Liz, can you hear me?
I can hear you, but things were really cutting out there. I didn't hear what happened.
I don't understand what's going on. I hope it's not a reception problem. Sorry, folks. We're trying to work that out. I hope it's better. Good. It has cleared up a little bit. But I think that's an excellent idea. Liz, what is the percentage of recruitment that they actually recruit in the military? Is there a percentage of students that are being recruited, and is it going up?
They've really been playing with the numbers. They've also been changing a lot of their own rules in order to be able to meet their recruiting goals. And so one of the things that we've seen over the last few years is that they'll state in maybe January that they want to recruit 20,000 people that year, but then they come up short. And so then they will, in June, reset their goals down to 15 or 16,000, and then they'll be able to trumpet that they met or exceeded their goals when they actually didn't make their original goal. They have changed standards. They've raised the age of enlistment. You can go in until you're 39 now. They have lowered the, you know, you have to take a test when you go in. There's a certain background check that they do. They're allowing people who've been convicted of crimes that previously were not acceptable as recruits are now acceptable in the military. People with lower scores on the aptitude test are being allowed to enlist. And so it's not, they're really struggling, and yet they trumpet that they're making their goals.
They are making their goals. Well, how do recruiters work when it comes to the adult persona? You're saying here that 39 is now the age of military enrollment. So how do they recruit adults?
Well, when you've got an economy that's struggling, when you've got mortgages that are skyrocketing and people are afraid that they're going to lose their homes, and they want to provide for their families, and they know that they're going to get a big fat enlistment bonus. And they've just recently started doing this, and this is interesting because they've been for quite a while lying and saying you won't go to Iraq. They're now offering a $20,000 bonus if you sign up to go to Iraq within a few months of enlisting. And in certain areas, they're getting takers. I'm actually proud to say that in my county and the next county over, where I've really been working hard, they haven't gotten a single taker in that program.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, Liz, this almost sounds conspiratorial when you think about it. When you think of the outsourcing of our country, when you think that the war in Iraq was something that had in the workings for over 20 years at the hands of Paul Wolfowitz, when you see all of this kind of the outsourcing of our jobs, the absolute lack of control of our borders, do you think that this was an anticipated event?
I do. I would like to think better of our government, but there are so many things that just seem to feed people right into the military machine that it's hard not to wonder what is really
going on. Well, exactly. When you're talking about the No Child Left Behind Act and the clauses that have been slipped through, the Patriots Act that would have been slipped through, the free speech is being suppressed, the unresolved issues with our borders. President Bush, for 2 years, never even levied one fine against any business or business owner that hired undocumented illegal aliens. It just seems like there's just too many coincidences going on here.
Well, you know, a really big recruiting promise is health care for your family. Well, Bush is going to tooth and nail not to have health care.
Exactly. Wow. That's something I had never thought of. You're absolutely right. That is a really big, I mean, look at our what's happening in our election process now. That's one of the greatest stands and positions that our incumbents and our candidates are talking about is health care. And here they're offering your family, here, take this health care. There you go, and there's a $20,000 bonus. These people are desperate, and desperation makes for desperate acts.
That's right. But I do want to give some credit to the people who serve, and it's the thing that probably troubles me the most, and that is that there's a lot of people who enlist with the best of intentions of really wanting to serve and protect, of those high lofty goals that we talk about and that we hope that our country would really provide to the world and for our citizens. And it really makes me sad that some of the best-intentioned people in our country are joining the military to serve for what I believe is illegal, immoral, for a lie, for greed. And their good intentions are being lost. The lives, the things that they could do for our country are being lost and drained in Iraq and Afghanistan. And who knows where else next.
Liz, do you think that the draft is an inevitable consequence?
I worry about it. It's really interesting to watch them dance around it. They know that it's not politically viable, and whoever puts forth a draft is going to definitely, you know, be politically undone. And yet, how many times can you make a soldier redeploy? How much strain can you put on their families? The divorce rates are incredible. There was recently a study that said that military families, the children, have really high rates of abuse because the spouses that are left behind are incredibly stressed. Or when the soldiers themselves come home, the service people come home, they have PTSD and they are stressed. And so it's really putting this on the back of a few families without giving them the proper care or support.
Today we went to the theater, my husband and I, and we watched a movie at the behest of a friend of mine called The Valley of Elah, with Tommy Lee Jones and Charlize Theron and Susan Sarandon. It was an extremely, extremely extremely dark portrayal, but I don't think it was far off. I think a lot of people are not seeing or witnessing what is going on with the families of the people that are coming back. Indeed, a military is, I think, a necessary process in any country. We need to be able to defend ourselves, but this is not in an act of defense, as anybody sees it. And people like Aaron Watata, people like you, are doing things and making and taking actions that are not going to be favorable. I would highly recommend that you see that movie, and I think that children that are involved in this kind of work should see movies that are being put out there. It's called The Valley of Elah, and just an unbelievably amazing, dark portrayal of what happens to people when they are exposed to this kind of maniacal war. And, you know, as a peace activist, here we're talking about a situation where our children are being indoctrinated into not only the military, but into playtime that's violence. You're talking about video games and video game parties, so to speak, just to get these kids together and to experience this kind of violence. And what is to become of us as a society, Liz?
Well, I have hope, and I think it may take 3 generations from now before we finally realize that the path we've been going down is not working. One of the reasons that I have continued to work for Teen Peace, I mean, my kids have moved away. They've gone off to college. I didn't just do this to protect my children. I did this out of a real concern for young people. But in learning about peace and studying the peace movement in the United States and in other countries, you know, we've had opposition to every war we've ever fought in this country, from the Revolutionary War on up until today. And yet, we haven't found, the peace movement has not found whatever it is that needs to prevent a war. Not just getting 10 years into it and finally ending it, but to really prevent a war. And I believe that it will be from the next generation that they will find the answers. And that's why I just am so inspired by working with them and hearing their ideas of looking for new ways instead of doing the same old thing. I've talked to so many kids who, you know, in New York, there's a group, the New York Yayas, Young Adults and Youth Allies. They put on their own job fair so that they found organizations where young people could get a job so that they didn't have to feel that they were only, their only option was to go into the military. And they included in their workshops not just people tabling to recruit for work. They also had workshops on how to rent an apartment, how to find health care, so that these kids really had survival skills, so that the recruiter's promises didn't matter. And that was the kids that came up with that. And it's those new ideas. It was the kids in Seattle who came up with the idea to only have the recruiters come to 2 job fairs a year along with everyone else. And
you know,
that's why
to,
I feel there's a lot of promise for us and a lot of hope. And it may be slow, but you know, I tell people, watching the peace movement is like watching a glacier move. But just like with global warming, those glaciers are moving faster. I've seen a lot more movement, and I am hopeful.
Well, we're going to have to wrap this up, but before we do, I want to ask you what you would tell parents to tell their children about recruitment.
There are a lot of ways to serve your country without having to kill other people, and we need to find ways to live in peace with everyone around the world so that we don't anger more people to encourage more attacks on our country.
That's absolutely wonderful. Again, I want to thank you. This was very informative, Elizabeth. There are many things that you have made me aware of, and I know many of our listeners and to the ways of our government again infiltrating our lives. And another way that is leading our children into harm's way. Elizabeth Rivera, I'm tripping up on that one. I want to call you Riviera. Elizabeth Rivera Goldstein of TeenPeace.org. Go to the site. Learn what you can. Teach your children that they have options, that we can indeed serve America without killing people. Next week's guest, folks, is Betsy Myers, spokeswoman for the Obama campaign of 208. That'll be Tuesday, October 9th at 8:30 to 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can listen live, or you can come to BBS Radio, or visit us in our virtual auditorium. The People Speak bid you farewell. Thank you very much for being with us this evening, and carry on the good work, Liz. Congratulations. What an incredible organization this is.
Thank you very much.
Good night, folks. That's it. The wrap tonight.
This land is mine, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. That ribbon of highway, I saw love made, that endless skyway, and I saw below me a golden valley, and I said this land was made for you and me. I roamed and I rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond desert, and all around me a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. There was a high wall there that tried to stop me, and there was a sign that said, it said private property, but on the other side it didn't say nothing. Oh, that sign was made for you and me. And the sun came shining when I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling, and a voice was chanting that the fog was lifting. Yeah, this land was made for you and me. One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the sea wall, by the relief of the fast, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering, if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.